Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Pro Lacrosse Podcast. I am Kyle Devitt, the Gear and Lifestyle Editor for Inside Lacrosse, and today I am joined by
Chris Rosenthal, Inside Lacrosse freelance contributor and pro lacrosse analyst.
Ooh, man, we are going to tell you all about the Ship Snakes and how they did it, how they beat the Redwoods in OT. But first, we got to do the MLL recap. It is Chris's week to cover the MLL. I will handle the PLL duties. But pivotal weekend, deciding the seeds for the playoffs. Chris, tell us about all the games.
All right, let's kick things off with the Chesapeake BayHawks 13, Denver Outlaws 11. This was down in Annapolis. It looked like a huge crowd because it was the end of the year, and they do a thing where they give out tickets to basically all the kids in the local public school area. So looked big. Hopefully that carries over to next year and they keep the crowd going. So a lot of kids there, a lot of people who weren't there, however, notable absences on both sides. You know, we've had the world indoor lacrosse conflict going on right now. So a lot of those guys went up and played in that. So Denver's attack, pretty much, this is perhaps not related to that, but also there were a lot of people sitting out. Like, for example, John Grant Jr. was still out. He was not playing. He was, you know, coaching. They said on the broadcast that he was on the injured list. I hadn't heard anything about that. So let me see if I can find something out a little bit more about that, do some digging, and see what's going on with Jr. But he was once again out. Not like they needed him, you know, to suit up this weekend. We already know there's no home field advantage. They've already got that locked up because the neutral site is in Denver. So, Denver's attack's pretty much replacement guys. Christian Knight was in goal instead of Dylan Ward. I thought he played pretty well. They actually jumped out to an early lead thanks to, you know, primarily the play of Jack Jasinski kind of setting up the offense. It was running through him early. Then Chesapeake's poles took over. And if you are a fan of long poles playing offense, this was the game for you. Apparently, C.J. Costable got a new stick before their previous practice, and I don't know exactly what he switched to, but it changed everything, and he's ripping corners, he's cleaning up ground balls, he was an absolute monster. Him and Chris Fennell were, like, teaming up, one's putting the ball on the ground, the other one's picking it up, running the point. It's a huge trade-off. Denver had some great pole play as well. It was just a pole offense clinic. Kind of funny, because we've just been talking, I think, a week or two ago, about how Chesapeake had been a little more silent in that regard, and they definitely changed it up for this game. BayHawks had a couple absences as well. Primarily, you know, so Brian Phipps was in goal, and I think he's just the guy now, because Nico Amato was there as well. It doesn't look like they've been switching off, so I think maybe he's just the guy moving forward, although he did have some clears that caught the eye of their coach, being a little bit upset, some turnovers that could have been avoided. So we'll see if Nico gets a start in the future, but they're kind of running out of time for that sort of thing. Most of all, most notably, Lyle Thompson was missing because he was off playing in the ERCON national team. However, he was actually planning to travel back to Chesapeake during his off day and play in this game because he was closing in on the single season scoring record. That being said, he didn't end up doing that because he got hurt very early in the first game of the tournament against Israel. And as of now, is yet to return. You know, keep an eye moving forward, but he has missed their previous games. So, you know, let's just start right there. So, Kyle, they do have this bye week coming up. But if the Thompson injury is serious and it spills over to the MLL semifinals, exactly how far do you think the BayHawks' chances can fall?
Very far. I think you can almost count on Lyle for 8 points a game. Especially in a pressure situation, especially against a poor sliding Atlanta Blaze defense. Without Lyle, Colin Heacock's got to really step up. Nick Mariano's got to step up. Stanwyck's got to step up. They've got to have 3-4 point games each minimum to beat the Blaze, because the Blaze offense is still good despite everything else that they have. So I think it actually, like, It puts their advantage of being the number one seed basically to nothing if Lyle doesn't play.
Right, and it is, like you said, it's kind of a mess, and the Blaze are all about what we've seen so far, you know, 20 to 21 games and elements like that. They're going to give up a lot, but they also have this propensity to score. So we'll see if the Bayhawks can, in fact, match that sort of intensity. Colin Heacock, like you mentioned, he had a fantastic game. Got caught on both sides of the ball sometimes, but was not a liability on defense either. Very physical, playing offense and defense. Just bowling guys over left and right. And aside from Heacock, who I mentioned, the Poles were also huge contributors in this one and really kind of sealed the game for them. I had a little incident where Isaiah Davis Allen gets an unsportsmanlike, and Denver climbs back into it with a two-pointer, but it was not enough, and they still ended up losing the game. So that was about it for them. Let's see. Let's move on to the next one, shall we?
Yeah.
Dallas Rattlers 16, Boston Cannons 15. One of just the rack of one-goal games on this particular day. Both leagues and indoor, it's just a crazy one-goal game sort of day. Ton of guys out for this one. So you had a bunch of guys from the practice squad getting bumped up and getting some shine, getting some run. It didn't really affect as far as the intensity goes or anything like that. Just, you know, notable absences once again. Kyle Jackson probably being the biggest one from Boston being absent and playing in the indoor tournament. That being said, Tate Boyce was in goal for the Cannons, starting for the first time. So now, I guess if you are going to extend the season, and that was, you know, the goal, starting it later and extending it a little bit, both goals that they met, I guess this is just a problem you're going to run into from time to time. It's not going to be a constant problem, but it is, you know, for this year. So do you think this was just kind of, you know, this sort of having to bump up, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, I guess a B squad for a lot of players. You think it's just kind of a necessary evil, or do you think they should have done something differently schedule-wise to avoid this?
I mean, I think they're – it's funny because MLL got praised in a couple things. I was – a couple threads on Twitter, they were being praised for not playing their championship during the World Indoor Lacrosse Championships. And it's kind of like, yeah, but like they're still playing the games that decide the seeding for the playoffs – and certain teams are going to have guys and certain teams aren't. And do MLL fans know about that? I don't know. I don't know if people showed up expecting to see Nick Morocco in cage and they didn't get him. You know, I think in Boston's case, listen, like they play, they've had a very consistent roster and they're resting guys, right? I don't think they should be or can afford to, but that's what they're doing. I think Boston is actually the last team that should be resting guys, considering how many mental mistakes they have made at the end of games in the last month. And they did it, not, you know, not to spoil it, but they did it again here. Wild.
Yeah, I think to go back to one thing you said a little bit earlier, I do kind of wonder if, say, the typical MLL fan or like the person in the stands is a bigger fan of the team or of the individual players. So I don't really know. Like, I don't have the answer to that. So, you know, if you get, you know, a bunch of kids from, you know, the youth team, they want to go to a Cannons game. I'm not sure if they went to this game and they were like, hey, wait a second, where's, you know, this guy, where's that guy? Or if they just want to see the Cannons play. I don't really know how deeply the typical fan gets in that regard. But you did mention mistakes, so I think that's the perfect sort of warp zone here, because the game was really close throughout the whole thing. Tied at the half, tied heading into the fourth. Three fourth-quarter ties. Basically, Rattlers call a timeout with 35 seconds left. And I don't know what's being said, but something was definitely said. And Boston head coach Sean Quirk gets called for an unsportsmanlike conduct during the timeout, like getting fired on your day off.
Yeah.
Mark Cockerton's got to serve the penalty. Rattlers pass it around. Rattlers goal, 13 seconds left. That is how they win the game. Repercussions from that? Cannons lose their shot at the number one seed, and instead they drop to 3, and they will face the Outlaws in Denver. They were 1-2 against the Denver Outlaws this year. Good news, that one came in Denver. So there's that. But the bad news, the last time they played, the Cannons lost 22-9. So there's that, too. Dropping to that 3 seed, big deal or little deal?
I mean, I don't think it matters at all because it doesn't change who they're playing, really, right? Like, that didn't really matter. I don't know if they match up with the Outlaws better. But they have played all right against them a couple times. They just are not consistent, and that's the problem. But the other thing is Denver's lost a bunch of games to Chesapeake lately. So I feel like this is another example of MLL has so little roster consistency, regardless of the excuse, that it's hard to prognosticate, like, these seedings, right? Is every team going to put out their best team? Like, please say yes. You know, like, obviously you have to win the championship. But how many guys are going to end up being, you know, this guy's still injured, or he's not ready to come back, or get injured in the indoor championships, like Lyle? Like, we don't know. And I think that kind of, not that it's a distraction or that those things are bad per se, but if something like that happens, they are bad for these teams trying to win championships. So I don't know. I think, you know, listen, I've been where Quirk was. I have gotten a flag at halftime after the time was over, and just talking to a ref, like, I thought we were having a private conversation.
Right.
And he trapped me. I'm gonna be real with you. I'm gonna tell this story real quick. He trapped me. So I was like, hey, can we, like, you know, even up the calls a little bit? Like, my guys are getting killed out there. Like, my team wasn't very big. We were getting nailed into the ground. Like, guys were getting second hits on our guys. And the ref just kind of looked at me, and I was like, so we can do that? And he's like, are you saying that you don't think the game is being called equally? And I was like, well, I mean, if you look at the penalties, you know, no. And that was his trap. And he threw a flag. And I was like, you threw a flag? Wait, the game's not happening. What are you doing? And he's like, you want another one? I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? Throw it. You know, just like getting in his face. And he was like, yeah, throw it. And then the other ref's like, are you done? I'm like, do you have any more flags? Let's go. And my team is like watching it like, what is he doing? What's happening? And finally my assistants come and like kind of like pull me away before I even knew what was happening. But listen, these refs out here, they're tricky. They got me in a trap, and I couldn't get out of it. I couldn't run through that trap like Rambo. I couldn't do it. So I let him know what was up. Don't be like that, by the way. That's not a good story. That's a bad, angry Kyle coach story. So, but hey, listen, I've been there, is kind of what I'm saying. So, Coach Quirk, we're good.
They did you dirty. That is not cool at all.
Yeah, it happens.
That's wrong. But yeah, man, I can't get over that. That guy's just a jerk. Let me tell you that. So I think, as far as the seeding goes, honestly, I'm kind of the same, but I don't think it really matters too much. I feel like these guys have all kind of taken their shots at one another. I don't feel like it's anything cut and dry, like a paper, rock, scissors situation, you know, where it's like, oh man, you know, now that they're facing this team, they're automatically going to the championship. I think, seriously, at this point in this league, any given day, any of these teams can do something well or do something poorly and just get smoked or smoke the other team. So, you know, maybe if it matters to them, that's one thing. But I don't really see any advantages either way.
Yeah, I mean, that's the exciting part, right? Is like we can kind of predict. And obviously, you know, last week we kind of put our hat on the Outlaws and the Bayhawks to win it. But I mean, if Lyle's out, I think the advantage and the home field is in Denver. Like, you give all the advantages to Denver. If everyone's healthy, all things being equal, I think they're definitely the favorite, even though they've lost the last couple games. So yeah, it's interesting. I think also, let's not count out the Blaze just because they have all these great offensive weapons, and you know, maybe the other team can't hit their shots, and then the Blaze beat you. That's how they win. So if you can't hit shots, they win. But I think in the next game, the other team hits some shots. Am I right?
They hit some shots indeed. I got to say, I'm going to start this off by saying this was by far, MLL-wise, the most fun I had watching a game this weekend. And no offense to the Blaze, who were on the receiving end of the beating, but it was just a fun game to watch. Lots going on. Lots going on in this one. New York Lizards 21, Atlanta Blaze 15.
Ooh.
Yeah. So Lizards, as we know, they're not going into the postseason. So this was their last stand. And, you know, they could have let the season kind of get them down to the point where they phoned it in, you know, where they're just kind of showing up, going through the motions. Also, they were going to have, like, these new uniforms for the game, but then like the uniforms got lost in the mail or something, or they weren't going to show up on time. They had like a FedEx issue or something, so they didn't have the uniforms. You know, it's just one of those days. Nothing was working out great for them, but they came out and they performed just like the best they could have possibly imagined. Closed out the season just on a dominant note. The second half was so very one-sided, hands down the Lizards' finest performance. You know, do have to go through the same thing again. Blaze are missing Randy Stotts, Brian Cole, Mark Matthews, Shane Jackson. But first half, they're still going toe-to-toe with the Lizards. It's not like Lizards just came out and ran over them right away. So the things got a little bit chippy, is the easiest way to put it, and a little wrestling match broke out during the game. You kind of think of people are going to get tossed, but they kind of just went, you know, called like slashes and stuff like that. And, you know, I guess cooler heads prevailed, but also close to halftime. But whatever happened during the halftime break, like, I don't know who said what, but the Lizards came out of the locker room and just absolutely destroyed the Blaze. Outscored them 12-5 in the second half. Face-off advantage 8-0 in the fourth quarter. It was a mess. Like, for the Lizards, this was the dream. Like, you know, when they're putting them together, this is how, like, the season was supposed to go. Everybody was working well together, having a good time. The fans are loving it. Rob Pinnell, this is my favorite Rob Pinnell performance of recent memory. He's tossing behind the backs. He's tossing bounce passes. He had a bounce pass. I don't know if they've posted it yet online or anything, but the beautiful thing about this bounce pass was it was necessary.
Yeah.
There's him and Crowley, and there's two Blaze players between the two of them. And if he tries throwing it, it's not getting there. But he throws a bounce pass, and it gets there, and Crowley just rips the laser. It was awesome. Dylan Malloy's scoring all these goals, having a great time. He's throwing his hands in the air as his music's playing. You name it. Great game. Great way for the Lizards to close out their season. Great stuff going forward. Another thing I found interesting, post-game interview, player of the game was Rob Pinnell. For obvious reasons, he finished the day with 9 points. 5 goals, 3 assists. Crossed all these thresholds. Crossed the 200 assist mark for his career. It's the 6th player in MLB history to do that. Just great, great Pinnell performance. Final question of his player of the game interview. And here is direct quotes. Broadcaster says, and again I quote, "We had a great talk with Joe Spallina in terms of looking for the draft next year and roster player changes as well. This is such a proud franchise with a great tradition, and moving forward, we anticipate good things from the Lizards." And Rob Pinnell responded to that statement about, you know, good things moving forward with the Lizards. He responded by saying, and I quote, "Yep." And then just dead silence. And then the announcer's like, "All right, Rob, well, congratulations on the win. Have a great night." First of all, what do you think about that exchange?
I'm not really surprised. Are you surprised?
No, not at all. When the question, I mean, it's not really a question so much, just kind of a statement, but like, when it was being presented, I was leaning in with curiosity about what this answer was possibly going to be. And I mean, what else do you say if you're a Pinnell and somebody says that to you?
I don't know, man. My favorite thing to do whenever we talk about Pinnell and I go on Twitter and people talk to me about it is post that GIF where he's like, "Oh, I've never felt more explosive." It's like my favorite thing to do. Like, I'll put it in out of context all the time. It's just such a great quote. And like, this is the real life version of that. Because yup, in this case, is pretty explosive considering the context. I mean, maybe he just didn't want to be in the interview anymore. And he was like, "I got to go home. I got to do a CrossFit session. I got to get ready, you know, go hang out with my family. I got to do some other stuff. I got to like go to the gym," all that stuff. I'm sure that like that went into his head. You know, "I got to sign a new endorsement deal with an energy bar company." Like that's the dude's busy. I get it. No shots. But that dude's giving you the commentator's giving you an opportunity to, like, listen, let's be honest. This could have been, like, his goodbye. If the last word from Rob Pinnell in an MLL context is him saying yup to that question, that's not a disaster for Rob Pinnell. That's a disaster for someone else. So, I don't know. You could read into it a lot. I just did, obviously. You could go a lot of different ways with it, but it's pretty indicative of where his headspace is at, I think, and where it might have been all summer.
Yeah, I think, so, I mean, it's definitely not, it's not just an alley-oop sort of thing. You know, you could have said something like, you know, hey, you know, thanks a lot. You put up a bunch of points this year. You've been a great model for the franchise, blah, 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 stuff like that. You know, it does kind of hold the door there. He doesn't really walk through that door, of course, because, you know, we don't expect him to do that. There's been a lot of clues that would fuel at least some rampant speculation.
I think that's the
easiest way to put it. Right.
And the most accurate.
Right. A lot of clues that might fuel the speculation. That being said, it was if this is in fact, at least, you know, for the time being, the last time we see Rob Pinnell in a Lizards uniform for a while, he went out with such an awesome performance. I cannot stress enough how great it was. It was just fun. It was fun. It looked like he was having a great time. It looked like the team was working well together. Everyone was having a great, great time. So good for that. Good for him. I do want to say this, though, since we are talking about the future a little bit. If you are Lizards GM Joe Spallina, who are you taking with the first overall pick next year?
First, I'm finding out who will play for me, and then I'm taking them. I think the one thing this team needs the most is probably some more defensive help, but they also need a top offensive midfielder. And if that means you pull up to Doc Aiken's house with a bag of money after his season's over, then you go do that. Otherwise, like, what are we even doing? If the Lizards take another attackman, out of all those great attackmen, it doesn't matter. If they take another attackman, I will lose it, Chris. I will lose it. They've got 8 attackmen already playing midfield. They lost all their games because they have 8 attackmen playing midfield. Fix that problem. Get a real midfielder. Get a real shooter, a real playmaker that plays midfield. Stop converting people. It doesn't work. It does not work. And failing that, just honestly, if you have to trade down and just buy, like, go out and buy all the best, or draft all the biggest, baddest OG New York style enforcers to play defense, and that's what you do. Because that the identity of this team is so wrapped up in Pinnell, and then it became wrapped up in Malloy, and, like, will they work? And the answer is yes, eventually, but it was too late. So you got to change how you're building your team here, because this is not working. This what they did this summer did not work, despite the results of this game.
Yeah, and it was a real shame, but it was good that we got to see kind of, you know, it's like when a group is just fighting all the time, but then they pull it together for the final presentation or whatever it is. You get an A on your final project, or, you know, that concert comes together, whatever it is. There's been all these bumps along the road, and then you see this one thing, and you're like, oh, man, that was really nice. It could have been more like that, but...
But it wasn't.
See it for a little bit.
But it wasn't.
So before we're done with the MLL, you know, wrapping up, last thing for the MLL stuff, they announced their awards finalists very, very recently. 3 for each position. Any differing opinions on these sort of things? I guess, you know, some of these guys who made it to the finals were, I guess, not even people we had discussed before. And you know, I'm not sure. Is this entirely, do you know, because I'll just come out and say, I don't entirely know how these are composed. Is this all still the voting? Is there a fan voting? And then another sort of thing?
No. So the nominees, I think, were assembled by the league and coaches and GMs. Because that's how MLL's always done it, no matter what they tell you. That's what they've done. So that's why these, and like this year, I think they kind of had to do that because I don't even know if all the fans knew how many people were rookies because so many people were new. And that's not a shot at the fans. I just think that there wasn't like a ton of communication of like who is, just because this person's new doesn't mean they're a rookie kind of thing. You know what I mean? And especially with the three teams folding, you know, there was a lot of movement. So you started the year and then you kind of had to like learn the players from game one. These will be decided by fan votes, from what I understand. And you can vote on the website now.
Let me see if you have any thoughts on any of these. Rookie of the year, it's between... Did you already say no?
I said yes.
Oh, okay.
I said yes.
Oh, okay. Rookie of the year, Chris Aslanian, Justin Pugel, or Alex Woodall?
Aslanian, obviously, for me.
Yeah, I do have to say, though, those are all talented rookies. Yeah, sometimes I feel like that's the kind of category where you have to throw somebody in just to balance it out.
Yep, I agree.
And I've been a big Aslanian fan, but Justin Pugel a lot as the season has kind of gone forward. The past few games, I really liked him. Offensive player of the year, Mark Cockerton, Randy Stotts, or Lyle Thompson?
I disqualified Cockerton because he got blanked this year in a game they needed to win. So it's between Randy and Lyle. They could do the thing where they double Lyle. They Posque him. They give him Offensive Player of the Year and MVP. But I doubt they'll do that. And I think enough people will vote for Stats. But, like, maybe not. Maybe Lyle is the most recognizable name here and he gets all the votes.
Yeah, this is it's kind of the sort of school of thought that, you know, you kind of subscribe to one or the other, where it's like, okay, if an offensive player is up for MVP, should he also just be the offensive player of the year? You know, I mean, it's not like Lyle plays defense as well.
Right.
So, you know, can you be the most valuable but not the offensive player of the year? I don't know. I'm cool with giving it to two different people. I guess I can't justify it in a logical sort of way. I guess, you know, but I would say I would vote for Stotts just because, I don't know, I just enjoyed his performance. And I'm going to, spoiler alert, say Lyle for MVP.
And Stotts got blanked too, so maybe by the criteria I disqualified Cockerton, maybe I should do that to Stotts too. So Lyle, yeah, all the way.
I don't think Lyle got blanked. I'm pretty sure.
Nah, never.
Yeah. Defensive Player of the Year: Liam Burns, Rylan Reese, or Finn Sullivan?
Liam Burns is qualified because he's on the Blaze. he's a good player. He's a great player, but like you can't have a Defensive Player of the Year come from a team that played the worst defense all year. You can't convince me that's okay. You can try, but you can't. In terms of what they, like, just playing defense, right? It's Finn Sullivan. But if you're talking defense and impact in other areas, it's Rylan Reese. So I think Rylan Reese has gotten a better push from Boston than in terms of media and like kind of putting him out there for their fans than Denver has done with Sullivan. So I think Reese will win.
Yeah. It's interesting that like you have one sort of pure close defensive player in this. And then, you know, Burns is kind of floating all over the place. Sometimes he's close. Sometimes he's LSM and Reese. You know, I like all of these guys, I gotta say. I had not thought of the approach that if your team keeps getting smoked, maybe you shouldn't be up for Defensive Player of the Year.
I'm sorry. I could be wrong. Listen, tell me if I'm off base. That's just how my brain works. I'm sorry.
No, yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I was going to say Burns, but now I'm going to have to rethink that because you've introduced a new element to the
to the equation. Here. Yeah, the element of logic is it's a tough one.
Yeah, that's tricky. Finally, MVP, we got Cockerton, Zach Currier, of course, and Lyle Thompson.
It's Thompson.
Yeah, I think it is too.
Did you want to talk about rookie? Oh no, you did talk about rookie. I meant goalie. Sorry.
Oh, goalie. I actually left him off here.
So goalie is Madelon on the Blaze, Sean Scannone on the Rattlers, and Dylan Ward on the Outlaws. Our dude Nick Morocco shut out here. I think it's between Scannone and Ward. What do you think?
I definitely think it's between those two. Scannone was such a huge impact sort of guy, but I feel like the longevity of doing it all season could play into going for Ward.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's weird that Scannone's not nominated for rookie. I think that's weird.
I agree with that as well. I mean, you know, just make it four guys, because I feel like if you take Woodall off, the, you know, Blaze stands will show up with the receipts. And, you know, he has shattered all sorts of, like, records and taken a million face-offs and done this and done that.
Yeah.
So just make it four people and put Scannone on there, too.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't do that. One last one, too. The Tito's Coach of the Year got a sponsor for that one. That's an odd sponsor.
That's great for the Coach of the Year.
Shouldn't I go to the not Coach of the Year? It's like, here's a bunch of Tito's. Had a rough year. Tough one, man. So it's Cottle for the Bayhawks, Sean Quirk for the Cannons, or Tony Seaman for the Outlaws. There's cases to be made for all of them. I want to actually say Quirk, even though we kind of like just like buried him with the he got a penalty and cost his team a game move. But that team went from like the worst team in the league for like 3 years to the playoffs. So I feel like if you're checking the receipts, the Cannons fans are going to come for that. And I think they're going to vote him up. And the Cannons have been pushing their guys. So, you know, I think I give him a little bit of the edge here, even though I think Cottle and Seaman in particular did phenomenal jobs. You know, Cottle being the steady hand of the Bayhawks and Seaman kind of replacing BJ O'Hara and kind of out BJ O'Haring BJ O'Hara in some way and making this Outlaws team kind of not really lose too much of a step with him leaving.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that the Outlaws were really strong defensively coming back this year. But attack-wise, like when I was trying to figure out which coach I would give it to, I'm still really impressed on what they were able to throw together with that attack. You know, just guys that, you know, Aslanian and Lee and then Junior kind of working his way in, first a little bit and then a lot and then right now not at all.
Right.
That seems like a really sort of tricky gig.
I mean, they played like 20 rookies this year. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, not all year, but, like, throughout the year, I think they've dressed at least 19, if not 20. I know it was 18 last week, and I think they dressed new players this week. So, I'm just going to say they dressed 20 guys, different guys on a team that haven't played in the MLL before and still have the second best record. So, I'm gonna give some dap for that. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Seaman. I think there should be, like, a front office of the year award too, because the Outlaws just constantly put this sort of thing together.
Yeah.
So, but there isn't, but there should be.
There isn't, but there should be. The motto of the Inside Lacrosse Pro Lacrosse podcast. All right. let's go to the PLL championship, baby. What do you think?
Let's do it.
Oh man. I gotta be honest. I don't really know where to start. What do you think? We go with the drubbing and then we take a trip on a ship?
I think we have to go that way.
Okay. In the number one pick game, the Archers dropped 25 goals on the poor throats of the Atlas, who managed just 7. This will forever be known as the Will Manny game, if I have my way. 11 points, 7 goals, the best individual statistical performance in PLL history, only Connor Busick's 9-point performance a few weeks ago comes close in my mind. Chris, on a scale of soft tap to the back of the head to hammer fist on a down opponent's face, how bad was this beatdown?
So this was definitely hammer fist on the downed opponent, but they are down because you hit them with a bus beforehand.
Yeah, that bus. went to Canada. The Atlas were missing huge pieces in Baptiste, the aforementioned Busick, and Kieran McArdle, as well as other players as well, you know, all to the U.S. indoor team. Do I think all of those guys would have played if the Atlas were in the championship game? Yes. Is a game between two teams and for the number one pick a great idea? Maybe. But this year, it felt a little unnecessary. Only because the shortlist of great players to select in the 2020 draft is large and might be the most talented class we have seen since 2013 and 2014. For those of you at home, 2013 draft class was Peter Baum, Tucker Durkin, Scott Ratliff, Marcus Holman, Will Manny, John Hawes, John Rannigan, Eric Law, Dominique Alexander, JoJo Marasco, and Brett Schmidt. Okay, sounds great, right? How can 2014 be better? It is. 2014, Schreiber, Jordan Wolfe, Joe Fletcher, Kieran McArdle, Michael Earhart, Mike Chanichuk, Steve DiNapoli, Austin Kaut, Jackson Place, Mark Cockerton.
Whew.
That is wild. And I think the 2020 draft is just as good as those, both of those. I don't know. I was going to say put together, but then like I kind of went down the list and I was like, wow, I think Cockerton puts this over the top for 2014. So because that was the year he got picked late because people didn't think he would play MLL. I remember that distinctly writing the preview for that year. So I don't know. It might be better, to be honest. I mean, maybe not more diverse in terms of positional like impact, but in terms of offensive players, it's as good. It has the potential. The potential of this class is that good. So in that way, it's great because it gives more onus on that pick. But like, if you're picking second, like, are you upset? If you're picking third, are you upset? No. If you're picking fifth, you're still getting a starter. It's crazy. So I don't know. The whole time I'm watching it, I'm just like, oh, make it stop. Make it stop. They have families. Oh, man, this is brutal. But as I was watching it, I turned to someone sitting next to me and I said, I think this game is over. And that was sometime in the second quarter when the Archers were up 9-2. So still early, but you could see the writing on the wall. Atlas couldn't win a draw. Concannon was getting besieged with shots at that point. The Atlas made a little mini run, but it was somehow still too late going into the second half. After that, it was just, listen, this was a haunted house of a game. Bloody and scary, but ultimately only satisfying for one side. Postscript to that analogy, I worked in a haunted house once. It's not as fun as you think to dodge hysterical punches and scare people. It just isn't. It sounds cool. It's not. Don't go work in a haunted house. We're just giving you life lessons here. I'm trying to help you make a better decision. I think we learned some things that I know I've known, and I think you've known for a while watching PLL this season from this game, that this game definitely hammered home for me. First thing, if you don't dress the best team possible, you will lose. Second thing, if you leave Manny and Holman open, they will destroy you and your life. And three, team defense matters way more in these games than people think it does, because everyone's like, oh, the shot clock, you'll get it back, you'll get the ball back, you'll get another chance. No. No. Good team defense wins and creates blowouts and close games alike. And that was extremely evident here. Are these fair conclusions to reach, Chris? Or once again, I must ask you, have I lost it?
These are all very, very fair conclusions to reach. The level of talent is certainly high across the board, but not only dressing the best team possible, what stuck out to me is just a matter of experience. You know, if you're bringing some of these guys out here who are playing their first or second games of the whole season,
yeah,
they're going to kind of wander in a little too deep, I think. And, you know, maybe that's something that next year they'll kind of have some guys, you know, if you want them on your roster, maybe you'll get them in, you know, 3 or 4 games or something like that. Just so you have this sort of depth. You know, I mean, this weekend wasn't a surprise, right? You know, even if you didn't know you were going to play in the first round draft pick, you know, you were probably planning to play in the championship, but you're definitely planning to still be playing. So if you have guys who are going to try to figure it out as they go along, it's going to be a bad day for you. Point number two, absolutely, Mandy and Holman are – it is so ridiculous how quickly Will Mandy gets the ball out of his stick.
Yeah, yeah.
And into a corner. It doesn't make any sense. Like, if you've held a lacrosse stick, it doesn't make any sense. And Marcus Holman is like what, a split second maybe of a release, a little bit slower than Manny's, just because Manny's is, like, the fastest.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. They're both – you can't give them any space at all.
It's Steph Curry and Klay Thompson.
Yeah, yeah, they're both just monsters.
Yeah.
And, yes, team defense matters so very much. Not just having a good individual or two or three good individuals, everybody working together as one.
I think, you know, this game was a great microcosm of adjustment, right? So I personally think, and talking with players afterwards, I wrote a story about Mandy and Holman that's on Inside the Cross right now. You can go check it out. I think, and they confirmed this, the Archers took a long time to adjust the PLL style. And I think they didn't truly figure out a successful philosophy until the end of the season that blended their offense and their defense. When we saw that roster at the beginning of the year, we thought, man, they're going to sling the ball around and seriously mess up some defenses. And I think they probably thought that too. But the thing that was missing for them was true two-way guys and consistent transition play. And they absolutely unlocked that in the last few games, whether it's, you know, I've dinged them for their subbing and their patterns. They definitely got better at that. I think that they, you know, Scott Radliff in particular, like, played his best games at the end of the season. And listen, Holman had 6 goals. I know Manny had 11 points and 7, but, like, Holman had 6 goals. It's not, you don't sneeze at 6 goals. You appreciate that. That's the sock trick. I think the Archers have a lot of momentum going into 2020, not just because this was a blowout. They won 5 of their last 6 games. They're a legit team. Like, they are figuring it out, and I think they have figured it out. And I think if you add Pat Spencer and whoever they pick number one, if it's TD or someone else, they might be like a favorite to get to the championship game. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I can definitely see it. You know, when I was watching the game, I thought it was similar sort of thing. I didn't know that they had won that many games until you just pointed it out. But watching this game, I was thinking they're really putting a lot on tape for next year. And, you know, not only for the rest of the league, you know, everybody's on notice now that these guys are very capable, putting together a very strong performance. They're not messing around. Also, potential draft picks, they now know, okay, this isn't a project I'd be joining. This is a team that could gun straight for the championship next year.
Yeah.
And that's got to be very appealing to some of these guys who might be the first overall pick.
On the other side of the ball, what do the Atlas do now? Do they just take it as a beating and blame the loss of those players? Or is this like a reason to make some changes? I don't know. I'm asking you.
So I think it's both. Like, I think they could say, oh, well, if Trevor was doing our face-offs, we would be more successful in that regard, right? Because they were like, I think they were 24% or something like that.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's one of the things where they could say it and it doesn't just sound like excuses. But that being said, I don't think you can universally say, oh, well, if all of our guys were back, we would have won this game. So I think it's both. I think they have to, you know, they can attribute some of it to a little bit of the loss of those players, but they have a lot of off-season questions to ask themselves, because it's really about, like, how confident are they in people they have on the roster right now? can you really afford to say, no, you know, we looked fine. We were, you know, we almost made the postseason. You know, they had the, you know, if the Redwoods didn't score all those goals in week 10, you know, hey, the Atlas would have been there. It's like, if you want to hang your hat on just that, okay, but it might get ugly next year if, you know, you regress a little bit more. So, yeah, they have just the way the roster's constructed. You know, we've talked a lot about all of their attackmen, you know, trying to rotate in, or you having them play in midfield and that sort of thing. They have a lot of questions to ask themselves, and they're going to have to shake some things up, maybe.
What happens if TD isn't the first pick? And who do the Archers take then? And how bad does that move mess up everyone else?
So Archers are kind of in a similar spot where they're – it's one of those sort of situations where, like, I don't think they have that many questions, but they do have to ask themselves how close they are to a championship, you know? Like, do they – so assuming Spencer shows up, then I feel like their attack is pretty taken care of. Then are they looking for a midfielder? But then you have to wonder, like, does this person work with Tom Schreiber? Or, you know, is he going to be like the midfield Robin to Tom Schreiber's Batman? Or are they looking for, like, a second line midfielder?
Yeah, is Pat Spencer playing or not?
Right, yeah, there's a, you know, do they want to, they had some kind of, the third, I mean, I was going to say the third defenseman, because they had placed McMahon for, you know, pretty much all of the whole season. And then, you know, they have like Goran Murray, and then Conroy took his place. I think there was a third person who kind of worked in there as well.
Corley.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. They have some questions as well. I don't know what their defensive personnel is going to look like heading forward. Is Michael Simon going to stick down at close? Is he going to be LSM? He's run both in the past. You know, that's up for their discussion, figuring that out. I honestly don't know where they go if they don't take Erwin with the first pick. I mean, maybe they take a midfielder and have him in a role kind of like the McIntosh role has been this year, and just hope for some more productivity. You know, they kind of, I don't know. I don't really envy these teams with the first overall pick.
Yeah, the I think the teams will be made in the second round, actually. I think that's really where, like, yes, these first six players are going to be impactful, and most of them are going to be starters, but whoever gets, like, I don't think JT Giles-Harris is going in the first round, but if he's the first pick of the second round, it's going to the Archers, and that's awesome. So he helps a lot of their problems, especially if Place comes back at 100%. Like, that's a – he fixes a lot in terms of speed and off-ball and on-ball and a lot of that. You know, Jared Connors from UVA is another guy that can help them out. So I think it's interesting. I don't know what the actual answer is, but I think that's kind of the fun of the offseason. And I am looking forward to a pro lacrosse offseason. I really am. But before we get there, we have to talk about the PLL Championship game. Whipsnakes 12, Redwoods 11 in overtime. Chris, I was in the house for this one. This was the most exciting pro championship I've ever seen. Not the best, but certainly the most exciting. Why? I think it starts with the Whipsnakes dominating the scoring in the second quarter once everyone got their nervous energy out in those first 12 minutes. And then it comes down to offense versus defense. And even before that happened, the goalies, phenomenal from the jump. Troutner, fresh off his Rookie of the Year trophy. Burnlore, seething with rage that he didn't win anything despite being on the best team. It was the perfect goalie storm. That's why the first quarter was 1-1. Because those goalies wanted people to remember, hey, we're here. We matter. I think in terms of analysis, the Whips used the clock really well to set up their plays during that run. They would not take early shots, but they made early runs, if that makes any sense. So it was almost like they kind of sent the canary into the coal mine to see what the defense was going to do. Like, they'd run a guy down the alley with the ball, but he was never going to shoot. They were just kind of seeing what the defense was doing and what the adjustments would be. And then they would find the match, and then they would go kind of halfway through for their first attempt. And then they would kind of milk it until the last 15 seconds and go on that one. And then they would send the subs early so they wouldn't get caught in transition, which I thought was super smart of them. I think the problem for the Redwoods, they just couldn't put together a run because they couldn't get the ball. You know, and it wasn't just faceoffs. It was, they had a couple like one and done pretty stupid possessions. They could have, like, you know, pushed those out a little bit. But honestly, it kind of, all of that went out the window, right? All of that went out the window. The full field shot from Brent Adams that tipped by Berg and went in was in person unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. Like, the place exploded when that went in. And then the place exploded when it wasn't a two because they were mad. When you watch this on at home on TV, what was that like just watching it happen on TV?
When that happened, I literally yelled, "Oh my God." Not like, this is not like a exaggeration and I typed it or something. No, I was literally like, "Oh my God." It just, it's so much just highlight after highlight stuff packed into a championship game on NBC with all these people watching and talking about it and just, you know, tweeting about it or whatever. I mean, how do you ask for something more than a shot from 1,000 miles away that at first looks like it just, you know, goes in clean?
Yeah.
Which is just ridiculous. And then it actually turns out that it bounces off of the tip of Westberg's stick.
And he did it on purpose.
And it still goes in.
It's crazy.
It's absolutely insane that it would happen at all, let alone the biggest stage that that the league has had. It was just ridiculous.
One of the things that I think, you know, and we talked before the podcast about this to make sure, but it was clear to me in that kind of second quarter that Jules Henningberg was limited after the third shift in a row where Harbison was playing Omid. Like, I was watching the game and I was yelling, "Why is this happening?" But we found out afterwards that Jules was indeed hurt in some way during the game early on. But I don't know why he just wasn't on the field in kind of the second part of the game. And I don't know why you didn't, like, if he's good enough to dress, because he's still got touches in the second half, why not, like, put him out there and decoy him and pull a pole away? It seemed really weird to me. Like, what did you notice that at home? And, you know, we weren't given a secondary feed, so, like, I didn't really know what they were saying, but apparently they didn't really address it. Is that weird? Like, what were you thinking when you were watching it?
So I caught no mention of it. I mean, I'm going to say with at least 98% certainty that they didn't say anything about it. If they did, I certainly didn't hear it. It seemed like a strange... So I didn't see Jules Henningberg get hurt or anything.
No,
like that.
Neither did I.
Yeah, so it just looked like a weird strategy. I was like, oh, what's... I was like, how come... Because I was like, okay, so, you know, they've got the extra attackmen. You know, they don't just run three. So I was like, okay, so I guess Westberg is in there. And I'm trying to figure out why it would be him and not, like, them rotating or anything like that. Because, like, you got Kavanaugh, you got Garnsey. And then Berg had just never left once he came in. And I was like, okay, is this, like, an experience thing? Do they like his matchups more? Do they like his kind of physical ability? Is he there just because he has won so many championships? Do they like that aspect of his game? I just couldn't figure out where he went. I didn't know, because Jules Henningberg, you know, had been initiating from X, kind of trying the speed moves, you know, changing the planes. It hadn't really been that successful, but I didn't think it had been so unsuccessful that they were like, "You sit down, you can't play anymore." So I had a lot of questions about that.
Yeah, it's one of those kind of things that happened in the game that was insane, and this game was insane. The Redwoods down by as many as seven come all the way back, and I think, you know, Greg Rillian, I give him a lot of credit, because I feel like Nardella was winning stuff clean, and then Beast just kind of went, no more, and he started mucking it up, and he started jamming, and he would wait for the light touch and kind of fall forward if there was any sort of scrum. By the way, this game had a legendary scrum in the fourth quarter that had people cheering in the stands for like players to get the ball. It was awesome. You know when like you see people that are like, oh, the ball's on the ground all the time, is a bad game. Like, no. Sometimes when the ball's on the ground, it's because everyone's getting murdered around the ball, and you're just like, oh, who's gonna get it? It turned into one of those, and I was here for it. I loved it. But I think that wasn't the peak of the madness. The peak of the madness was the fourth quarter two bomb from Sergio Perkovic that was like the next state over. He was like a full, it looked like 10 feet back in from the two-point line. When that went in, the pop from the crowd was unbelievable, and that just took the game to another level. But waiting on that next level, the boss of that level, was Matt Rambo. But don't take my word for it. Let's bring in Whipsnakes head coach Jim Stagnita to talk about the game, the moment, the PLL is his first season, and being a head coach right now. We'd like to welcome into the podcast Whipsnakes, or perhaps Ship Snakes, head coach Jim Stagnita. Stags, how's it going?
Great job.
Congratulations on your first ever PLL championship. You've been a pro coach for a while now, but what has made this season different from other experiences for you in particular as a coach?
Well, from a professional level, it was the closest season that I've had to kind of what a college season was like. It was it seemed more real. The interactions were more often. The preparation and the commitment, I feel like, from the players in the league was at a level that, you know, I have not experienced at the pro level. And it just made for an experience where I felt like I was actually, you know, truly coaching and making a difference, you know, as compared to some of my kind of previous experiences in professional lacrosse. So, you know, one of the reasons I get into college coaching in the first place was because of the, you know, the player interaction, the opportunity to, you know, to hopefully develop and make people better and, you know, and to, you know, be able to, you know, to work towards a common goal with, you know, with a group of people that, you know, that have the same kind of shared outcomes. And I felt like, you know, that was the feeling I had this year as the year progressed.
A lot of PLL teams were constructed with, you know, these built-in groups of players that have previous connections. The Whipsnake squad in particular was dominated with Maryland players. Did that make things easier for you? Were there any challenges with that sort of situation, bringing all those guys in from the same college team?
I mean, there were some challenges. You know, a group like that presents its own set of maybe different challenges. I mean, that being said, Kyle, I think what was most helpful is that I had coached a number of these guys before at the professional level, and, you know, had relationships with them, so they were able to, in short time, when you got to get to know some new people and you're actually handed a team instead of, you know, kind of putting a team together yourself. I think that those previous relationships probably helped more so even than the fact that they are all from Maryland. I mean, they all are from Maryland, but they do come from different generations at Maryland. But there is, you know, there's the piece of it too where, you know, you get all these guys together from the same program. It's a little bit like a family. You know, they're pretty hard on each other at times. And, you know, while they're hard on each other at times, they also try to fix the problems to make it, you know, to make it work and to make it right. And, you know, that doesn't always show itself in a way, you know, in a way of wins and losses. And, you know, we had to work through some challenges through this year. And every time, we kind of ran into a challenge, and we addressed it. We, you know, the one thing that the really good teams do and championship teams do is they, you know, they learn from the challenges and the mistakes, and they adapt. And, you know, I felt like, you know, some of that stuff along the road helped us down the stretch.
I think fans, like casual fans, might know you as the classic never satisfied coach archetype, just because, you know, with all the interviews and video content that PLL has done, that's kind of your persona, I guess. What's something that you would say during a game that might surprise people that have only seen that side of you?
Well, I think it depends on what you're watching. You know, I mean, if you truly look in the huddles, it's, you know, it's about, you know, kind of just relaxing. It's about enjoying the, you know, enjoying the opportunity, enjoying the moment. But, you know, at the same time, you know, it's always about, you know, we have the ability to do this, and we do it as a team. You know, I was probably, you know, as a younger coach, you know, I always have, and it's funny the way you put it. I mean, not funny, but it's, you know, it's not something that's lost on me. I really have high expectations for the people who play for me, and I always have. And a lot of times my expectations for individuals are higher than theirs. And that's what's, you know, that's what's great about coaching, is that if I can get people to accomplish things and do things at a level above and beyond what they think they're capable of doing, you know, then we tend to be successful. You know, I also I'm a little bit more guarded than probably some of these younger guys, based on my experience about what I actually do say and don't say. So, you know, some of it might be a little bit more calculated than, you know, than what you might hear other people say. But I think if you ask the guys and you talk to the guys, they'll tell you there's the, you know, there's the lacrosse Jim Stagnita, and then there's the other Jim Stagnita, which, you know, probably the casual fan doesn't ever really get an opportunity to know.
I think I know the answer to this, but was that ending of the PLL championship the wildest ending that you've ever participated in as a coach?
You know, I can only compare it to one other. And that was, you know, one of the times I went back to Syracuse with the Rutgers team, and we beat them in overtime. And the last play of regulation, there was like a second left, Kyle, or 2 seconds. And one of Syracuse defensemen just wound up to, could have been to throw a full field pass to the goal, or, you know, I don't think his intent was to hit our attackman, but he hit our attackman right in the chest. And believe it or not, in the dome, they threw a flag, and we went into overtime and won with on the first possession on a man up. You know, that was, you know, yeah. I mean, the ending of this game, I was prepared for it, and our team's been prepared for it, because that's kind of been, you know, the script of the league through most of the year. You know, you get out. You get a lead, and no lead is safe. If you're inconsistent or the ball bounces a few different ways, you know, you're gonna find yourself in a dogfight down the stretch. You know, was it an unbelievable ending? Yeah, I mean, you know, you look up at the clock with a minute and 5 left, and we're down a goal, and we honestly hadn't been winning faceoffs, and the ball, you know, hadn't been bouncing our way. You know, I think most people would think we were dead to rights, but we've, you know, that's not the first time we've done that this year down the stretch of a game. I think that, you know, once we settled and got in the huddle, I don't think there's anybody in that huddle that didn't believe we had an opportunity still to win that game.
So let's talk about it a little bit more. You go down by a goal, you get the ball back, you go right to Rambo. He scores the game tying goal, and in overtime, he does the same thing to win it. I think everyone watching knew that Rambo was the number one option, but who was the second look if they kind of jumped that pick or doubled or tried to shut him off?
Well, you know, one of the things that I try to impart on these guys is when we do something that is set, there's always a lot of options. And the great thing about Matt Rambo is that with him and the way he's played this year, he's going to recognize the other options he has, you know, and he did, you know, if someone slides to him and opens up another opportunity, he's going to find it. I mean, he's had as many assists as he's had goals this year. You know, he has really been, his game has evolved so much over the last couple of years. So coming around that, and it pick, flip, however you want to, you know, it was a flip, and coming around and getting a half a step, you know, we had a Mumbo pick on the ball side. So Mike Janichuk's coming off that pick. And if they slide or they decide to, you know, to stay in the inside, you know, Mike hopefully is popping out with his hands free on the corner. We have a sneak from X. But because of that Mumbo pick, they played it, and there really was no one to, you know, to step up to Matt. And, you know, Matt had a step or two and tucked his stick and was able to put it away. But there, you know, there were a couple other options that, you know, that we could have executed. But, I mean, certainly option number one is Matt Rambo getting to the cage.
Your embrace with Rambo at the end of the game, followed by a Gatorade bath, was probably, you know, one of the more iconic moments of the weekend. Can you describe what has gone into forging your relationship with Matt before this season in the PLL, and kind of how satisfying that conclusion was for you?
Matt's, he says it, and it's kind of funny, but I have a son who's a college athlete, and you know, I have high expectations on him, so I'm particularly hard on him. And you know, I've had Matt for a couple of years, and Matt's a character, you know, there's no question about it, but he's also really talented. And, you know, we've had a lot of talks over the last couple of years about, you know, him making that jump to truly being a professional and making a living in this sport, and what that, you know, what that looks like and how you do that. And, you know, being a free spirit, I think, you know, if partway through this year, with, you know, with a little nudging from me and certainly some help from his teammates, I think Matt truly embraced, you know, what it's like to be a professional athlete, the impact that he can have, not just on the team, but on the league and on the fans. You know, and again, that sometimes, you know, when, you know, it's like you said with my son, he will, you know, sometimes you lash out at the people that you care the most about. And I get that. And you know, I love Matt Rambo. I'm so happy for him and for our guys, and our guys have so much confidence in him. He can have a really long career and he can make a huge impact on this sport. And, you know, I truly believe that. And I feel that it's, you know, it's kind of my responsibility to, you know, to help him do that as, you know, as his coach and somebody who cares about him.
We're going to wrap this up with a pretty broad question here. What has been the best and worst part about being a head coach in the PLL this season?
Well, you know, the fact that it really felt professional. It felt like I was in a big time environment coaching professional athletes week in and week out. It was really, it really felt like that. I mean, the games, you know, you're a coach. The games were like, every game was like college playoff game. I mean, you never feel safe. The momentum, the speed of it was unlike anything I've ever been around. So I think the quality of it and again, the feeling that I was really doing something at a really high level and making a difference, it made it enjoyable, and doing it with guys that I really love being around and that I, you know, that I was forging relationships with and that really cared about, you know, the outcomes. And, you know, that was, it was an unbelievable experience in that regard. You know, the hardest part is that there are so many good players on that roster, and week in and week out, trying to decide what the best combination is and making decisions and knowing how much the guys who didn't get to play on that weekend kind of cared and how important it was to them. You know, it was hard. I mean, it's always been something I struggled with, even as a college coach. You know, I understand, you know, what it's like for those guys, and I know how important it is and how badly they want to get out there and play. And, you know, they were easy conversations, but I always tried to have them as much as I could.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Coach. Congratulations again. And we'll be seeing you in the off season. Should be an interesting time.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
So I think it's interesting to get Stags' take on that game. I mean, everyone, even he knew that Rambo was getting the ball at the end there to score the game-tying and winning goals. But I think it's also interesting to hear him explain how that decision was also because of his playmaking ability and not just his scoring touch, right?
Yeah, I think it's just kind of what he's been doing all season, where, you know, you've seen these great goals and you've seen him turn in the corner on these defensemen. And I guess it's understandable if someone does say, oh, okay, that's what he's good at. You know, he's really good at driving from X, you know, putting down a shoulder, maybe a question mark, you know, maybe just digging inside and firing, things like that. But he also has a ton of assists as well. And he almost ended the game in regulation with an assist to kind of skip through. It just went a little bit low to Carlson, I believe it was. But, you know, sometimes you just need a quarterback. And he's the quarterback in that situation, right? You just give him the ball and you say, all right, finish this off. Let's go home.
He's like the Brett Favre of pro lacrosse. Because he's like a gunslinger. You know, he's the cowboy. I you couldn't be more of a fan of Matt Rambo after watching this game. There's no way. Like, no one is out there that still hates Matt Rambo after this game. Unless you're a Redwoods fan, and then you definitely hate him. But I don't know how you don't respect him after this. And you heard Staggs kind of talk about it a little bit as well. Like, Staggs saw it as his job to make Rambo better. And that's incredible. And also his teammates kind of pushed him to that next level, which, you know, he's the MVP for a reason. It's not just because he's, like, good at some stuff. He's good at so many things, and his technique is so good. Getting back to the game, I think this will be remembered more as like a classic because of its crazy second half than the first half. And the last 10 minutes, I mean, if the last 10 minutes of this game are on, I'm watching it. It, to me, that makes it an instant classic. If you arrive to this game in the fourth quarter, even if you like know what's going to happen, I feel like you're watching it. It's like Tombstone, right?
That is high praise to say something is like Tombstone. But I will agree with you. It was just a remarkably just chaotic, you know, just everybody flying around. You know, you mentioned that scrum earlier. And, you know, there aren't a lot of games where you can just say that scrum, and I know exactly what you're talking about. But this is one of those games. I mean, it was just... it was phenomenal. I'll definitely, it's still on the DVR. It is not going anywhere for a long, long time. And I'll be checking it out for quite a while.
I want to talk about the last play for a second. So before the podcast, Chris and I were going through the last couple of plays. And what's crazy about it is that Rambo gets the ball down low, right? And he comes over and sweeps for that arc. But if you look away from the ball, you see the guy that was next to Rambo on that low block sprint, and it looks like he's just running away. But what he's doing is running to the box for a sub. Rambo scored that goal short-handed. He made it. That dude made it to the box. There were 5 whipsnakes on the field when that ball went in. That is insane. It's just, it's so insane. Another guy that was instrumental to the whipsnake success this season was Jake Bernhardt. Got a chance to catch up with him earlier this week. Talked to him about his first season in the PLL, some of the hardships he's gone through this season after losing his father, and how it feels to have siblings playing in the MLL and the NCAA. Let's take a listen to that right now. Welcome to the podcast, Whipsnakes midfielder, or should I say Ship Snakes midfielder, Jake Bernhardt. What's going on, man? How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Congrats to you on your first ever PLL championship. This squad, ton of University of Maryland connections. You know, John Tillman was in the house watching. You led the team out onto the field for the game. What was that moment like for you before you even... the whistle even went off?
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty surreal opportunity. You know, a lot of us obviously never played in a PLL championship and wasn't really sure what to expect. And it sure did disappoint walking out to that environment. I thought it was just an awesome venue. Fans were incredible. I mean, overall, the game was just absolutely insane after being able to take a step back and watch it. So it was awesome.
Yeah, that actually leads into the next question. You've played and coached in some exciting games in your career. Was that championship against the Redwoods the most exciting conclusion you've been a part of, and why or why not?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to be tough. I mean, that's hard to, I guess, put up there with Team USA, the way we finished the game with Tom Schreiber in the last seconds, but it's definitely right there with it. You can just feel the energy from the stadium and the ebbs and flows of the game. It was just unbelievable.
You've D'd up some of the best players in the league this season. Who is the most annoying person to guard? Not necessarily the best, just like the guy that's just frustrating. You're like, ugh, this guy.
I mean, there's a lot of guys. You know, one guy, I guess, you know, and I played against him a bunch growing up through, you know, the ACC when Maryland was in the ACC. But, you know, I think Jordan Wolfe is one of the toughest to guard, even though, you know, he's probably going to, you know, take you to his right hand. He's just so quick and you can't anticipate it, but, you know, he still finds a way to get to it and it just frustrates the hell out of you. But, you know, Jordan's also a good friend of mine. And, you know, if there's maybe a guy that I feel okay with giving up a goal to, it's Jordan.
Your brother Jesse is playing for the Chesapeake Bayhawks. Your brother Jared has announced he's looking to play football after his time at Maryland is up. What sort of guidance have you given each other throughout your careers in lacrosse? And was it weird, like, not playing in the same league as your brother this summer?
Definitely been a question that's been asked. You know, I think the most awkward time for Jesse and I was probably when we left Maryland and played on two separate teams professionally. And, you know, as we've been apart for a couple of years now with our separate organizations and now being in two different leagues, it's definitely weird. It's, you know, been difficult to keep up with, I think, both of us, one another, obviously rooting for each other, but, you know, just focusing on, you know, what we can control during the season and really be invested with our organizations and teams at the time that we're with them. And, you know, I mean, I think we're both pretty self-reliant people that there's not a lot of – we don't need a lot of motivation from either side of us.
Championship game aside, it's kind of – you know, it's been a difficult summer for you, losing your father. How has the camaraderie and friendship from this Whipsnakes team and your past teams kind of helped you through that event in your life?
Yeah, I mean, it was a difficult time. And the best part of it was, you know, through sometimes tough times, you have to learn how to do some things. And something that I learned was to be able to lean on some people. And I couldn't have done it without the group that we had with the prior relationships, playing at the University of Maryland and professionally previously. And then the new guys that I never had an opportunity to play with, you know, they were always there supporting me. And, you know, I felt you know, it was overwhelming with the amount of support that I got from those guys and also the lacrosse community in itself. There's too many great people in our game that, you know, that don't maybe get heard of sometimes. But it was, you know, very comforting to have those guys in my corner and be able to go to them on a weekend, each weekend that we had games.
You're the offensive coordinator at the University of Vermont. What is one surprising thing that people should know about both the program and the actual state of Vermont itself?
All right. So the program, you know, we're kind of just getting going here. You know, this is going into our fourth year, and we're really excited that, you know, to be here. Burlington is an awesome place. I know you've been here before, and I always tell people when they ask about it, I feel like it's one of the most underrated cities in the country. And I really always overemphasize that people really have to make a trip here. But yeah, I mean, we're just getting going here, and we're a really young group and really hungry and excited to get going during the fall and then also heading into the spring. And then I guess fun fact about Burlington, I think people mistake Burlington for a ski town. The Burlington is actually right on the water, and people fly into Burlington and go to the mountains like Stowe and Smug's Notch to go skiing. But Burlington itself is a town, is a beautiful place, has a great walking area and beaches, and it is just incredible, as you can confirm and attest to that. I know you can.
I absolutely can. New England boy never leaves. Jake, thanks for joining us, and congratulations on the first PLL championship, and good luck this fall and in the spring with UVM.
Thanks, Kyle. Appreciate it. I'll see you soon.
Ladies and gents, Mr. Bernhardt, super gracious with his time and a great example of how you can be a professional lacrosse player and an even more professional person. Chris, the PLL season is over. It's in our rearview. What is one thing you want to see from the league this offseason?
I want to see what the league plans to do to keep people interested. I'm not sure what that means, and it is not my job to think of what it means. But if they want to kind of maintain the grip on everyone, what are they going to do about it? Because, you know, it's much easier to have content when there are games and practices and training camps and things like that. And they are, I mean, without a doubt, far more content absorbed or fascinated. It's much bigger priority for them to churn out content. So now I think, obviously, it's difficult to do that throughout the season, you know, to have like a quick turnaround time and put your stories together and things like that. But I think it can get super tricky when you don't have everybody in one location every weekend. You know, what are they going to do to make people keep caring about the product? So that's what I'm interested to see, what they can do this off season.
I think the one thing I want to see is more transparency about, you know, sports league things. You know, guys can't just materialize on other teams. Not because it's hard to follow, but because that's confusing to everyone. You know, the process for that should be formal and spelled out. And I'm going to say this, maybe even have some dollar amounts attached to the salaries. Is that fair? Maybe? No?
Yeah, no, it's fair to me. Any sort of thing that we're accustomed to seeing other pro leagues doing, except for other pro lacrosse leagues, like if you're trying to make the leap between what we expect from regular pro lacrosse leagues to big time pro sports, there's some warts that go with it. You know what I mean? Like maybe you're not comfortable talking about, you know, dollar amounts, but we're comfortable hearing about dollar amounts,
yeah,
because we follow football and basketball and things like that. What is their free agency plan? Yep. Like, how do you pick guys, hypothetically, who weren't in the league last year but are now going to be eligible to be in the league? How are they going to get on a team?
How about guys that played in the other league? Are you going to let them in? Which ones are you letting in? Which ones are you letting go? If that's a thing, that's I'm fascinated to see that. I think everyone listening is also fascinated to see that. And that actually leads into my recommendation of the week. And that's, I just want to tell you, if you're listening to this, if you paid attention to our content for the PLL and the MLL all summer, please keep doing that in the off season, because that's when they and we need you the most. If you want more top 20s, if you want more draft content, if you want more team breakdowns, let us know. Because basically we work for you. You know, if there's enough of a demand for a certain type of article or kind of article from you and it's public, we'll do it. We will do it. So it's in your hands as much as it is in ours, as much as it is in the PLLs and the MLLs. You know, vote with your interest. Vote with your attention. And you'll get everything you want and more from us. That's the only promise that we can make. We're not sure if you're going to like it. I can't guarantee you that you're going to like everything that we do for you, but I can tell you that if you want it, we're going to do our best to give it to you. Chris, what's your recommendation of the week?
My recommendation of the week is kind of like a half recommendation, half request, half suggestion. I know that's three halves, but you know what I mean?
It's a lot of halves.
Yep. I'm not a math major. I will come out and say that right now. My recommendation, go find some good fall music, because I don't know if it exists. And I've gotten used to, for the past, 14 weeks, making a playlist every single week. And now the PLL's done, I don't have any sort of playlist on deck. So I've done summer ones, but summer's over. I've done, Christmas ones, but it's not Christmas yet. I don't know if there's good fall music, because, when I think fall, I just think, wet leaves and stuff like that. But if there is good fall music, music that feels like fall to you, let me know, because I just don't know. But if I can find some good enough ones, maybe I'll put a mix together.
You know what? I'm going to go one more step further with that. If you're listening to this and you love the PLL playlist that Chris did, how about you give him a playlist? How about that? How about he did it for you for 16 weeks? Huh? He did all that work for you every Friday, like clockwork if there was a PLL game. He did it for you. How about you do it for him? Get together, crowdsource it. I don't care. Let's repay the man for his musical genius, please. That's all I ask of you. And with that, we're going to put a bow on the PLL season. We're going to move forward and talk about the MLL Championship next week. And maybe, oh, Lord help me, just maybe we'll update the top 20 pro lacrosse players right now. And by maybe, I mean we're definitely doing that. And we're already sorry. So, Chris, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at ChrisRosie22.
And you can find me at TheKyleDevitt on Twitter. Thank you for listening all season. Please keep listening. We're going to try and keep this going as long as we can, at least for another couple weeks. And hope you enjoy it. Thanks for everything. See ya.